Today is Friday, May 1st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, bleak new figures underscore the worldwide economic pain inflicted by the coronavirus.
Another 3.8 million Americans filed new claims for unemployment benefits last week. That alone would be shockingly high under any circumstances.
An extraordinary diplomatic dispute intensifying between Australia and China over the new coronavirus. Also, ahead of World Press Freedom Day Sunday, the pandemic is highlighting the need for journalists who are on the front lines of bringing truthful information. It's all on today's International Edition. The number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits climbed past a staggering 30 million on Thursday, while Europe's economies have gone into an epic slide as well. As the U.S. economy continues this historic free fall, President Trump is pitching good times to come, while some laid-off workers worry about what's next. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president says the economy will roar back soon.
I feel it. I think sometimes what I feel is better than what I think.
In New York, what laid-off tour guide Ethan First feels is sadness.
I just want my job back.
He's getting jobless benefits without them.
I really don't know how I'll get by, how I'll be able to buy groceries.
Gabby Knamm lost her job as a restaurant line cook and hasn't received any benefits yet.
I'll be able to make rent next month. But after that, if unemployment doesn't kick in, then I'm definitely in trouble.
Even as the economy slowly starts to recover, Bankrate.com's Mark Hamrick says people like First and Nam may be among those left behind.
Just how many of these workers will be called back to their jobs?
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Well, businesses around the world are reporting record losses. Unemployment numbers continue to be high as governments release stimulus packages to ease the financial blow. But the stock market has seen increases in recent days. To understand the economic situation and what may explain this, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to David Wilcox, a senior non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
You know, people who claim to be able to interpret the markets with certainty must have a different set of powers than I do. I think it's a very confusing mixed picture. The fundamentals of the health situation remain very serious. The virus is not yet controlled in the United States, and there's no assurance that it won't come back as some of the as states progressively reopen. We're going to be in a situation here with regard to how open the economy is, in a sort of situation of tiptoeing in and then running back, tiptoeing in and running back. And the running back will occur as the disease resurges. And then once it's under control, we'll tiptoe back in. I think what the markets are probably attempting to do is to balance all of that uncertainty on the health side with a massive amount of policy stimulus that's been provided to try to cushion the blow for those who are really seriously impacted by this situation.
If we take a look at the macro level of economics, the economy continues to move forward, slowly, but continues to move forward. Granted that each individual business is different and each sector is different, how good are things or how bad are things?
This is a eight-cylinder engine at the moment is not firing on several of its cylinders. It's a confusing picture where some companies are doing fine. Many companies that rely for their business model on human-to-human contact are nowhere to be found, and for good reason. For public health imperatives, their workers, for their safety, need to stay at home. There's no percentage in bringing a company back when the conditions simply aren't safe. So, Steve, the picture ranges all the way from companies that are only mildly inconvenienced, where the workers may be needing to work remotely, to companies that have flatlined. just to take the simplest example, thousands of restaurants across the country, of course, remain shuttered, and there's not any prospect that customers are going to be eager to come back and populate those restaurants in anywhere near the way that they did pre-coronavirus.
The coronavirus outbreak has taken more lives in New York than any other state so far in the United States. New York City's health department is one of the best in the world, yet it was overwhelmed by the number of cases of COVID-19. Dr. Thomas Frieden, a former New York health commissioner, later the head of the CDC, and now the president of a global program based in New York, talked about it with VOA's Carol Pearson.
Dr. Tom Frieden is president of Resolve to Save Lives, a global nonprofit designed to take on silent killers like heart disease. But these days, he's putting his public health expertise to work to contain the coronavirus.
I was born in New York City. I was a medical student here at the height of the AIDS epidemic. I did my training in public health and in internal medicine here, also at the height of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. I started my professional career as an epidemic intelligence service officer here in New York City.
Dr. Frieden's New York City is a far cry from what the city looks like today in the midst of a coronavirus pandemic.
I'm a New Yorker, and I'm just heartbroken to know the number of healthcare workers infected, the number who've died, the number of people whose lives we've lost. Every day in the paper, we see just a tiny fraction of the number of obituaries.
Currently, there's only testing to see who has the virus. There's no treatment for it and no vaccine to protect against it. To save lives, Frieden says societies need to follow the lead of public health experts.
Public health can scale up its traditional tools of testing, isolation, contact tracing, and quarantine. If you get those four things right, you can box the virus in. And by boxing the virus in, you can reduce the number of cases, prevent clusters from bursting out into outbreaks and epidemics, and increase the space for all of us to return to society.
Yet the virus will still be out there, and Frieden says it will still be dangerous.
No one should underestimate how deadly this virus can be.
Even after the worst of this pandemic is over, people will still have to take precautions, because if they aren't careful, Frieden warns, the virus will come roaring back. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The coronavirus pandemic is taking an especially tough toll on immigrants around the world. In New York City, a town known for its diverse population, immigrants are feeling increasingly uncertain about their status as they struggle to get access to legal and health systems in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Kim Nichols, co-executive director of the Harlem-based nonprofit African Services Committee, which is working to virtually assist African immigrant clients.
So there's a lot of work that goes on, but people are calling in and asking for support. Some of the teariest moments I've had have been during those phone calls.
Tell us about just one of those moments.
We had a client who's stuck in Alabama after having been in the criminal justice system there for a while, immigration-related case, guy living with HIV, and he's stuck in the hospital in Birmingham. And he called me just as this whole corona outbreak was surfacing back in early March and said, I'm ready to come back to New York. And I said, don't come back to New York. This is no place to be. And lo and behold, as the weeks rolled by, he's in as much danger now in Alabama as he would have been in New York.
For him and people like him, New York itself, which he made his second home, has become sort of a far-off, strange land.
Exactly. And because I'm in the office every day and I usually pick up the mail, I see how many filings are coming back from Citizenship and Immigration Services, as well as the Department of Homeland Security. These are the, sort of the residuals of immigration case filings that our lawyers have done over the last couple of months. Remains to be seen what the decisions have been in these cases. Hopefully these are not all denial letters, but it's a reminder that the system is still sort of grinding forward and people are constantly inquiring about green cards, citizenship cases, work authorizations, asylum.
How do you feel those inquiries these days?
We do have a hotline that runs a couple of mornings a week where people can leave messages and voicemail, and they will be called back by any one of the 11 or 12 attorneys we have on staff.
A huge part of your work at ASC is healthcare and screening. What are you doing these days on that front?
What we're unable to do now is face-to-face screening for all the various diseases that we normally test, ranging from hepatitis, HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, diabetes, hypertension. Our testing center is completely shut down, but we offer remote HIV testings where people can call and express interest in a home HIV test kit, which we'll mail to them, which will be returned to us and results given. And emergencies of a medical nature will do a referral over the phone.
What about the personal protective gear that is so important these days?
We've been trying to stockpile masks, gloves, gowns, and even personal thermometers to be able to give these to staff who will see clients and to be able to give them to clients who may have family members who also need masks.
The pandemic is causing mental and emotional anguish all over the planet, and I understand you've had to switch from face-to-face counseling to telemental health work.
We have two mental health counselors, and one of these facilitates a biweekly support group. And the other thing that we're doing that's kind of critical and that makes us an essential service is that our food pantry is still open, but we distribute bags remotely. We have sort of a vestibule that's completely enclosed and locked, so you can't get farther than the vestibule, but you can get into and pick up a bag of pantry food. And we have a staff person who drives pantry bags around to clients who are unable to travel or unwilling to travel on the subway.
These limits must be so frustrating for you at ASC and for other community nonprofits.
That's right. This time, it's almost as hard as caring for a terminally ill family member. You know, it has that same sense of like, there's a lot of love and a lot of loss and a sense things are going to change forever.
In California, Governor Gavin Newsom is closing all beaches in Orange County, just outside of Los Angeles. Ed Donahue reports.
Newsom had wanted to close all beaches in California.
We're going to do a hard close in that part of the state, just in the Orange County area.
Last weekend, about 80,000 people were in Newport Beach and elsewhere. The governor says many were not practicing social distancing.
95 souls were lost in the last 24 hours. I hope that's a point of reminder and caution in terms of the behavior that we're seeing just a few of our beaches in the state.
Police say people in Newport Beach were keeping their distance. One lawmaker says the governor doesn't seem to get it. We need to trust the people. Beaches in Los Angeles County remain closed. I'm Ed Donahue.
An extraordinary diplomatic dispute is intensifying between Australia and China over the new coronavirus. Canberra wants an international investigation into the source of COVID-19 and its spread, a move that's infuriating Beijing. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
China has rejected criticism from other governments about how it handled the outbreak of COVID-19. The highly contagious and deadly new coronavirus is thought to have originated at an animal market in Wuhan, a large city in China's Hubei province. Australia is pushing for an international investigation into the origins of the disease and how and why it became a global pandemic. While likely to have support from US President Donald Trump, France and Britain have said now is the time to fight the virus, not to look for who to blame. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, though, says the world deserves answers on the deadly COVID-19 outbreak.
Australia will continue to, of course, pursue what is a very reasonable and sensible course of action. It has shut down the global economy. It would seem entirely reasonable and sensible that the world would want to have an independent assessment of how this all occurred so we can learn the lessons and prevent it from happening again.
China sees the inquiry as a political witch hunt orchestrated by the US and designed to humiliate Beijing. Its ambassador to Canberra has hinted at retaliation and a boycott of Australian products and universities, described by a senior Australian government minister as threats of economic coercion. However, Long Zhu, China's consul general in the state of Victoria, says Beijing has acted in good faith over the COVID-19 pandemic.
China has attached great importance to international health cooperation. The Chinese government has released information related to the COVID-19 in an open, transparent and responsible manner.
Some experts believe Australia's relationship with China, already strained with allegations of political meddling and cyber espionage, is now at its lowest point since diplomatic ties were established in 1972. Australia has much to lose. China is its biggest trading partner, and its demand for natural resources has helped to underpin its recent prosperity. Before Australia closed its borders because of the COVID-19 outbreak, Chinese travellers and students were also important to the success of its tourism and higher education sectors. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Top African health officials say the continent has taken what appear to be effective measures in curbing the spread of coronavirus. While they note that lockdowns in some countries have had positive effects in slowing transmission, scientists say that the enduring economic and social harm of lockdowns could soon trump scientific considerations. Experts spoke to journalists the day before the continent's hotspot, South Africa, prepared to ease its restrictions. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Health officials across the continent have mostly succeeded in urging leaders to implement strict measures to combat the spread of coronavirus. And it may be no coincidence that the sub-Saharan African region continues to have the world's lowest caseload and the fewest number of deaths. But the crisis is far from over, says Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa.
In terms of the situation in Africa, we are continuing to see an increase in cases. I think our outbreak is continuing. We are seeing case fatality rate in the region of about 3.9%. We have a couple of countries that have a higher case fatality rate. What is very encouraging, and I'd just like to emphasize this, is that we have a number of countries that have reported zero cases over a couple of weeks. So these are admittedly relatively small countries, Namibia, Mauritania, and Seychelles. But they put in place as well some measures, early measures, starting with testing, contact tracing, which have produced some results. And then we are very concerned about West Africa, where we are seeing community spread in a significant number of countries compared to others.
In South Africa, the country with the continent's highest caseload, Health Minister Dr. Zweli Mkhize says a strict 35-day lockdown, which officially ends Friday, has made a difference.
We are actually seeing a slightly different trajectory that has pushed the peak of the epidemic to around September in the best case scenario, or maybe July in the worst case scenario. And this is going to be related to how we ease off the lockdown so that the president has called for a risk-adjusted easing of the lockdown to take into account the food security issues, to take into account the economic recovery that needs to be supported.
Mkhize noted that the reopening will be slow and not drastically different from the current situation. The next lower stage will include a curfew, limits on outdoor exercise, and the obligatory use of face masks in public. Large gatherings remain banned, and many so-called non-essential businesses remain shuttered. Professor Kojo Ansakoram, an epidemiologist in Accra, Ghana, says it's decisions like this that keep leaders up at night. How do they protect public health while also keeping other sectors of their country strong?
If you're in a place like Accra, where there's a large majority of people in the informal sector, for example, then that advice has to be weighed on or has to be taken in addition to what will happen to that population, which probably has to go out on a daily basis to get their daily bread. And so you can make your pure scientific advice, but you have to be aware that it has to be managed in the context of all the other things.
As of April 29th, Africa had about 23,000 reported cases of COVID-19 and just over 900 deaths, fewer than any other region in the world. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded that the new coronavirus was not man-made or genetically modified, but say they are still examining whether the origins of the pandemic traced to contact with infected animals or an accident at a Chinese lab. President Donald Trump and his allies have touted the as-yet unproven theory that an infectious disease lab in Wuhan was the source of the pandemic. Japan is preparing to extend its state of emergency over the novel coronavirus for another month. It was originally set to end on May 6th. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said even as some other countries begin to reopen after strict lockdowns, it would be too difficult to return to everyday life on May 7th, adding that the country needed to brace for a drawn-out battle. And Twitter says it will grant researchers and software developers access to a real-time data stream of tens of millions of daily public tweets about COVID-19, which they can use to study the spread of the disease or track information. Twitter said that this access could also be used by approved applicants working on crisis management, emergency response, or communication within communities, as well as those developing tools to help the scientific community understand COVID-19. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. The coronavirus pandemic is touching the lives of almost everyone in the world and has brought to light the many brave people on the front lines who provide security, medical care, and food. But ahead of Sunday's World Press Freedom Day, journalists in many ways are also being seen as critical frontline soldiers in providing truth and factual information for citizens looking to make the right decisions for themselves and their families. I recently spoke to Dr. Courtney Radge, Advocacy Director with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Here in part one of a two-part interview, we are talking about seeing journalists risk their lives, get arrested, banned, and taunted with claims of fake news from leaders uncomfortable with the truth. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Radge. Do you think it's safe to say journalists are, in fact, a frontline component of helping save lives during this pandemic?
I think journalists are one of the underappreciated frontline workers during the coronavirus. Of course, we are so grateful for the work that nurses and grocers and first responders are doing, but we really have to understand that many journalists themselves are first responders, especially photojournalists, video journalists, and those print reporters who are going out to the front lines, whether we're talking about the hospitals where people are being treated for COVID or whether we're talking about the vast social, economic, and political implications that this pandemic is having. And so, you know, we're really concerned at the Committee to Protect Journalists, both about how to help journalists stay safe, because they are oftentimes putting their health at risk to go report the story. Obviously, not every story can be told remotely from a computer or a phone. And we're really concerned about the blowback against journalists in many parts of the world and the press freedom implications of this global pandemic, especially as we approach World Press Freedom Day.
Of course, they're putting their lives on the lines if they need to go out and cover the story in real time. As you said, everything can't be done online, but also they've been threatened, they've been banned, they've been in some places around the world imprisoned just for trying to get the truth out about the virus.
This is an unprecedented pandemic, but unfortunately, some of the responses that we're seeing are not out of line with what we saw in the aftermath of September 11th in the War on Terror, where you had this widespread acknowledgement that terrorism is a problem, but it gets warped and misconstrued by governments around the world who then use that as a cover to clamp down on press freedom and on independent reporting. So that's what we're seeing with the coronavirus. We're seeing in countries like Iraq, Egypt, Iran, South Africa, really around the world, that journalists who are reporting on coronavirus, especially if it has to do with official statistics versus what other reporting is showing about how many cases or how many deaths there have been, that, you know, these journalists are then getting caught up and either, as you said, arrested, detained, in the case of Egypt, kicked out of the country. In the case of Iraq, Reuters had its license suspended temporarily. So there's this real battle over over the truth. And I think one of the challenges is that there isn't necessarily a truth. There is an evolving set of facts, which may look different over time as new information comes to light, as new discoveries about the virus are made. So on the one hand, there isn't necessarily one global truth, although there are certainly authorities and officials who have, you know, valid information. And then you couple that with the interest of many countries in controlling the information environment, in making sure that there is no information out there that doesn't comport with the official version of reality, which in many cases does not comport to reality. And journalists are getting caught in the crosshairs because theirs is a public interest job. Part of what they're doing is informing the public about how to keep safe, what is the situation on the ground. They need to report on what the authorities are doing, and they have to help hold those authorities to account during this unprecedented pandemic, especially when government authorities have so much power and are giving themselves so much power because of this pandemic. And so we need journalists to be holding them to account and making sure that the public is informed.
That would certainly require a journalist to really dig in and find out what is happening. Facts are so incredibly important right now in saving lives with this virus.
And the problem is also that this is not just about facts, right? Of course, the journalists are out reporting, you know, on coronavirus and trying to get at facts, but they're also reporting on what public officials are saying. And in many cases, in many countries, even the topmost leaders are not providing accurate information or are giving incorrect advice. Mm. So they're having to deal with, you know, how do they navigate that very complex situation? How do you report on something newsworthy that a president has said, while at the same time recognizing that maybe what was said is not accurate or is contrary to health advice? And of course, there are many stories that might not be directly about the spread of the pandemic, but every story now seems to have some sort of coronavirus implications. So whether you're talking about, you know, how this is impacting poor or disenfranchised communities, just trying to get out to those communities can put journalists at risk. We've seen attacks by police on journalists in India and South Africa, as well as by the public who doesn't necessarily understand, you know, what journalists are doing out there covering these issues. So journalists are facing a lot of challenges, and I don't necessarily think that much of the world really understands how essential their work is at a time like this.
Dr. Courtney Radge, Advocacy Director with the Committee to Protect Journalists, hear part two of our conversation coming up on Monday's show.
I see skies of blue.
Few cities are as closely identified with music as New Orleans. It's a destination for vibrant live performances that can be heard from just about every corner of the city. But the coronavirus and the social distancing measures have nearly silenced its music scene. Bars and restaurants where music can be blaring out until early morning hours are closed. Numerous spring festivals like this week's New Orleans Jazz Fest have been canceled. And the weekly second line parades on Sundays featuring brass bands have stopped. Funerals where mourners send off loved ones are over. But the city's musicians are finding ways to get music out to the people. Many are live streaming from their porches, studios, living rooms, front lawns, or wherever they can find space, performing the music they loved while bringing neighbors a small sense of hope. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good weekend. Take care and be well.
What a wonderful world. Yes, I think.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
and AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.